All right, everyone, get ready for a deep dive today. We're going right into the center of a legal battle that we're still feeling the effects of today.
Mm-hmm.
Picture this, 1937, the Hindenburg. Huge spectacle, huge tragedy. And even now, almost a century later, we're still arguing about what exactly caused that magnificent airship to go down in flames.
You know what I think is really fascinating about the whole thing?
Yeah.
It's not just the disaster itself that people couldn't agree on.
Right.
There was a legal battle about who owns the story, who owns the explanation for what happened.
Oh, wow.
That's where we get Holing v. Universal City Studios, a case that really throws a wrench into how we think about copyright when it comes to history.
So we've got one mystery, the Hindenburg, and then like a legal mystery layered right on top of it.
Yeah.
For those of us who haven't already gone deep into this case, can you like set the scene a little bit? What's the main conflict here?
Okay. So we start with the author, A.A. Holing.
Okay.
He publishes a nonfiction book, Who Destroyed the Hindenburg, in 1962. And he makes a pretty bold claim.
Oh.
Sabotage by a crew member, a guy named Eric Spale.
Interesting.
Years later, a novel comes out. Then Universal makes a big budget movie out of it.
Right.
And both of them, the book and the movie, have really similar plots to Holing's book.
Okay.
Holing is not happy about this, obviously, and that's how the lawsuit starts.
I'm going to guess this isn't just plain old plagiarism, though.
Right.
If it were just about copied words, I don't think it'd be nearly as interesting of a case.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Holing wasn't saying that they, like, took sentences from his book.
Mm-hmm.
His argument was way more interesting. He was saying they stole his research.
Oh, wow.
His unique interpretation of the evidence, his theory of how the Hindenburg went down.
So basically, the big question is, can you actually copyright a theory about what happened in history?
That's the mind-boggling thing at the center of it all.
Okay, before we get into the real nitty-gritty legal stuff,
yep.
Can we walk through that timeline one more time just to get a sense of like how much time passed between these different works?
Oh, for sure. Holing's book comes out in 62.
62, okay.
A full 10 years later, in 1972.
A whole decade.
Yeah. We get Michael McDonald Mooney's novel, The Hindenburg.
Okay.
And then just 3 years after that, Universal comes out with their movie in 1975.
So we're not talking about something that was just like thrown together really quickly.
Right.
There's a pretty significant gap between when Holing puts his theory out there and when these other works show up.
Yeah.
Hold on. If there's that much time between them, wouldn't a court just assume that Mooney and Universal just did their own research? Why even bother with the lawsuit?
Well, you might think so, but you got to remember, this is a pretty specific historical event. I mean, the Hindenburg is iconic, yeah, but how many different ways can you really explain why it crashed?
That's true.
And that's part of what makes this whole case so important. It makes us really think about some basic questions, like what does copyright even protect? Especially when it comes to history.
Right.
Can you own a fact? Can you own an interpretation? Where's the line?
Yeah. That's a really good point. So let's get into that legal side of things then. What does copyright actually protect when we're talking about historical events? Can you really say you own a piece of the past?
That's the thing the courts really had to wrestle with. And it gets pretty complicated.
Okay.
The main idea at play here is something called the idea-expression dichotomy.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. Break that down for me. What does that even mean?
It's not as complicated as it sounds.
Okay.
Basically, you can copyright the exact words you use to express an idea.
Okay.
But not the idea itself. Like, you can copyright a love letter, but you can't copyright the idea of love.
Gotcha.
Apply that to history, right? Holing, he didn't invent the Hindenburg.
No.
He didn't invent the idea of sabotage.
Right.
What he did was put forward a specific way of explaining how those two things might be connected.
So the court had to figure out, if Holing's version of events, his theory, was unique enough to be considered like his own creative work.
Exactly.
Oof, that's tricky.
And it's made even trickier by this idea of sweat of the brow.
Okay.
For a while, the legal thinking was that if you put in a ton of effort, that alone meant you owned it.
Right. So, like, if you spend years researching something, you should have some rights to it.
Right. But that creates all sorts of problems. Like, what if two people working totally separately, both come to the same conclusion after working really hard? Who owns it then?
Ah, so it's not just about the effort. It's about what you actually create because of that effort.
Exactly.
How did the court apply that to the Hindenburg case then?
Well, they basically said sweat of the brow doesn't automatically equal copyright. Copyright is supposed to encourage creative works, not just hard work.
Yeah.
It's an important distinction. And that's why holing is such a big deal. It really pushed those boundaries.
So how did the court actually explain their decision? Like, what was their reasoning?
Well, they explained everything in what we could call the four pillars.
Okay.
And these have basically become essential for anyone who's working with historical stuff these days.
All right, let's hear it. What's pillar number one?
Pillar number one says that historical facts and theories by themselves can't be copyrighted.
Wait, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Are you saying that if I spend years digging through archives, I find some brand new historical fact, someone else can just come in and use it, no problem? That doesn't seem fair at all.
I know, it might seem kind of counterintuitive at first.
Okay.
But imagine if it worked the other way around.
Yeah.
What if the very first person to write about, let's say, the Civil War, suddenly owned that whole topic? Nobody else could write anything about it without their permission.
Oh, I see.
Copyright can't be used to just lock down history. It's about protecting the way we express and interpret those facts, not the facts themselves.
Okay. Okay. I'm starting to see that makes sense. So what's the next pillar then? What's number two in this legal framework?
Pillar number two is all about this idea called scènes à faire.
Scènes à faire.
It's French. It means scenes that must be done.
Ooh, fancy French legal terms.
Oh.
I like it. Tell me more about these must-do scenes.
Okay. Think about it this way. Let's say you're writing a World War II story.
Okay.
There are certain things that are almost guaranteed to show up, right?
Yeah.
German soldiers. Maybe a tense scene with Heil Hitler salute.
Right.
A busy German beer hall. These are like tropes. Elements that are so common, so expected when you're writing about a specific time period or genre that they can't be considered someone's unique creation. They're not protected by copyright.
So how does this scenes that must be done thing apply to our Hindenburg case?
Well, the court said that some elements are just part of any story you tell about the Hindenburg.
Okay.
You can't copyright the fact that it was a German Zeppelin, that it was full of flammable hydrogen,
right,
that it burst into flames, that it had passengers on board.
Right, that's all just part of the story.
Exactly. These are like the basic building blocks, the scènes à faire of any Hindenburg narrative.
So you can't copyright the event itself. You can't copyright these common elements.
Yeah.
It's really starting to feel like there's not much left to protect.
Yeah.
Where do we go from there?
That brings us to pillar number three. It basically says that copyright protection for anything about history is purposely kept pretty narrow.
Okay.
This is to make sure that writers in the future will still be free to write about history.
Right.
Without having to worry about bumping into copyright rules all the time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It wouldn't be good for scholarship or for anyone exploring history creatively if every little detail was locked down under copyright.
Right.
We need some room to breathe, to reinterpret, to offer new perspectives.
Exactly. And the court was definitely thinking about that. They wanted to encourage people to create new works based on history, not make it harder.
Mm.
Now, it's important to point out this principle applies mostly to factual works. If Holing had written a novel about Spell and the Hindenburg, like fictionalized the events, it might have turned out differently.
So there's a clear difference between writing about history as fact and using those historical elements in a made-up story.
Right.
Okay. What's the last pillar in this whole framework? What ties everything together?
Pillar four is all about public policy, and it's a big one. Copyright can't be used to monopolize history. The public owns the past.
Whoa, that's a powerful statement. It really makes you realize that history isn't something that can be owned or controlled by just one person. It belongs to all of us.
Exactly. The court understood how dangerous it would be to let people control the narrative around historical events. They wanted to make sure that the past stays open for everyone to explore and interpret and debate.
So just to sum it up quickly, we've got these four pillars. Facts and theories can't be copyrighted. Standard tropes aren't protected. Copyright for historical works is limited. And history belongs to everyone. This case seems like it's basically a blueprint for anyone who's writing about history today.
It really is.
And it seems especially relevant for genres like true crime, historical fiction, documentaries. You know, anytime someone is building on research that already exists and trying to tell a compelling story.
Yeah, definitely.
It makes you think about all the authors and creators out there who are dealing with this exact issue. Take Eric Larson, for example, and his book, The Devil in the White City. It's a bestseller.
Yeah.
It tells the story of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, but also weaves in the story of a serial killer who used the fair as his, well, hunting ground.
Right.
It's clear that Larson used a lot of pre-existing research and historical accounts to write his book.
And thanks to cases like Hoeing v. Universal, he doesn't have to worry about getting sued for stealing someone else's work.
Right.
This case helps protect authors like Larson, gives them the freedom to build upon existing knowledge about the past without having to constantly worry about breaking copyright laws.
But there are limits, right? You can't just copy and paste someone else's work and say it's yours just because the historical facts themselves are fair game.
Yeah.
Oh, you're absolutely right. That's really important to remember. Hoeing v. Universal isn't a free pass to plagiarize.
Mm.
You still can't just copy the way someone tells a story about history. Their unique structure, their specific wording, the creative choices they make and how they present the information, all that is still protected.
Okay, so let's make sure we really get this.
Yeah.
What if instead of focusing on Hoeing's overall theory, Mooney had taken whole chunks of Hoeing's interview transcripts. Mm-mm. Would that be crossing the line?
Now, that's a really interesting question, and it gets right to the point of what Hoeing v. Universal is trying to clear up. In that case, yeah, I think copying interview transcripts word for word would probably be considered infringement.
Okay.
Transcripts, they're the direct record of how someone expressed themselves, their exact words, their thought process in real time. That's protected. But the conclusions that Mooney might draw from those interviews, the way he puts them into his own story, that's where he's free to reinterpret and be creative.
So it's all about this balance.
Right.
You can use existing research as a starting point.
Yeah.
But you have to find your own unique way to build on it. It's like you can take inspiration from the bricks, but the structure you build is where your own creativity comes in.
That's a perfect way to put it. And that's exactly the takeaway from Hoeing v. Universal. Yeah. You own the way you tell history, not history itself.
Mm.
You own the specific arrangement of words, the structure of your narrative,
right,
the style, the tone you bring to it. But you can't just lock down the historical events. They belong to everyone.
This is so important for anyone listening who works with historical material.
Yeah.
Whether they're writing nonfiction, historical fiction, or even a screenplay. So basically, to sum it all up, you own your expression, but not the facts.
Exactly. And to really drive that point home, I want to leave you with a quote from the court's decision. The public benefits from the author's work, but the author usually has to be content with fame.
Whoa, that's a pretty powerful statement. It makes you think, you know, about that balance between recognizing how much work goes into historical research and acknowledging that those findings, in the end, become part of a bigger conversation.
Right.
A shared understanding of the past.
Yeah.
So what does that mean, especially in a world where information is everywhere and constantly being reinterpreted?
It's a question that's still so relevant today. Does this focus on finding a new angle, a fresh take? Does that take away from the value of all the research that went into uncovering the historical facts in the first place?
Right.
Or does it challenge us as creators and researchers to find new ways to engage with history,
mm-hmm.
to build on what others have done before us while still making our own unique contributions?
This whole case really shows the tension that exists between individual creativity and this idea that historical narratives belong to all of us.
Definitely.
It reminds us that history isn't static. It's not just sitting there. It's alive. It's something we're all a part of.
Mm.
We're constantly adding our own voices and interpretations to the conversation.
And that conversation is made richer by having diverse perspectives, by having new voices offering fresh insights into stories we might think we already know.
Right.
Hoeing v. Universal might be about this very specific case, but it gives us a way to think about how we interact with history, how we balance the freedom to create with the responsibility to acknowledge and build on the work of others.
So if you're out there digging into your own historical research, if you're trying to tell your own stories about the past, remember this, the facts are for everyone to share.
Yeah.
But your unique voice, your creative expression, that's what makes your work stand out. That's what adds to our understanding of history.
And who knows, maybe your interpretation, your way of looking at things will be the one that starts a whole new debate, a whole new perspective.
Yeah.
It could add another layer to our shared understanding of what happened.
This has been such a great deep dive.
Yeah, really interesting case.
For all of you out there who love history, who love law, and who love a good story, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep telling those amazing stories from the past.
And until next time, keep thinking, keep learning.
What if instead of, like, focusing on the whole theory, Mooney had just taken, you know, big chunks of Hoeing's interview transcripts.
Mm.
Would that be okay?
That is a great question. It really gets to the heart of what the court was trying to do with this decision. In that case, yeah, I think if you copied interview transcripts word for word, that would probably be considered infringement.
Okay.
Transcripts, those are the direct words of the person being interviewed.
Okay.
It's their unique way of saying things. You know, it shows their thought process right there in the moment. And that's protected. But the conclusions that Moody might draw from those interviews, the way he weaves them into his own narrative, that's where he has the freedom to do something new.
So you've got to find that balance.
Yeah.
You can use the research as a starting point, but you got to build something unique on top of it. Kind of like you can get inspiration from seeing a pile of bricks, but it's the structure you build that shows your own creativity.
That's a really good analogy. And that's the big takeaway from Holding the Universal. You own the way you tell history, not the history itself.
Hmm.
You own how you put the words together, the way you structure the story,
right.
Your own style and tone. But you can't just claim the historical events as your own. Those belong to everyone.
This is so important for anyone who works with historical stuff,
yeah.
Whether it's nonfiction, historical fiction, even screenplays. To wrap it all up, you own how you express it, but not the facts themselves.
Exactly. And I think this quote from the court's decision really sums it up well. The public benefits from the author's work, but the author usually has to be content with fame.
Wow. That's a really powerful thought. It makes you think about the balance, you know, between appreciating all the hard work that goes into historical research and at the same time understanding that in the end, those findings, they become part of a bigger conversation.
Right.
A shared understanding of the past.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Especially these days when information is so easy to get and everyone's putting their own spin on it.
That is a question that we're still grappling with today. Does focusing on finding a new angle, a new way of looking at things, does that diminish the value of all the research that went into uncovering those facts in the first place?
That's a good question.
Or does it challenge us as creators and researchers to find new ways to engage with history,
yeah.
To build on what others have done, but still make our own unique contributions?
This whole case really highlights the tension that exists, you know, between what individuals create and this idea that historical narratives belong to everyone.
Definitely.
And it reminds us that history isn't just set in stone. It's not static. It's something we're all a part of.
Yeah, it's constantly evolving.
We're constantly adding our own voices and our own interpretations to the story.
And that's what makes it so fascinating. Having different perspectives, new voices coming in with fresh takes on stories we thought we knew, that's what makes the conversation richer.
It's true.
You know, Holding the Universal might be about a very specific case, but it really gives us a framework for thinking about how we interact with history.
Yeah.
How we balance the freedom to create with the responsibility to give credit and build on the work of those who came before us.
So to everyone out there who's researching history, is telling stories about the past, the facts are there for all of us.
Right.
But what makes your work unique, what really makes it stand out, is your voice. Your perspective, how you choose to tell the story.
And that's what helps us understand history better. And who knows, maybe your take on it will be the one that sparks a new debate, a new way of looking at things. Maybe you'll be the one who adds another layer to how we understand the past.
It's an exciting thought. This has been a great deep dive.
It really has. A really interesting case.
For all of you history buffs, legal eagles, and storytellers out there, never stop exploring, never stop asking questions. And keep sharing those amazing stories from the past.
Until next time, keep those brains working.